From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So the Supreme Court expanded same-sex marriage rights to the entire country. Advocates on both sides of the issue have got to be asking themselves, what now? What happens next? And part of this is a strategic question. If you've been fighting for or against marriage, now you're thinking, what's our next move? For the LGBT community, it's getting the country to transition from legal equality to what they call lived equality, because they say there's a difference. For those fighting same-sex marriage, one of the next battlegrounds is locking down religious liberties they feel are now threatened. But part of what comes next is also figuring out how to live together in the wake of a profound social transformation. That's not easy. None of this is easy. And we're talking about it today, after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're exploring the next step in the battle over same-sex marriage. I don't have to remind you, on Friday, the U.S. Supreme Court expanded marriage rights to the entire country, which gave kind of a legal sense of finality, but of course it didn't resolve a lot of questions, some social ones, not even some legal ones. So today we're talking about where the debate may be shifting. If you oppose same-sex marriage rights, where do you go now? And for the LGBTQ community, same question, what's next? We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us first on the program is Robin Fretwell Wilson, who is a professor of law at the University of Illinois. We should say she assisted the Utah legislature earlier this year when it enacted the compromise bill that provides non-discrimination protections for LGBT people while providing exemptions for religious organizations. Joining us from an office in Chicago, and Robin Fretwell Wilson, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Doug. I appreciate that.
So I guess I wanted to begin by asking just a general reaction to the ruling. I can't imagine you were surprised by it.
No, not at all. But not at all. Well, I'm not sure what else to tell you. I mean, it's a tough decision as a family law matter because it's hard to tell how much it lands on due process versus equal protection. But the big sort of slogfest between the dissent and the majority is really on the question you're raising in this program, which is, what does it now mean for religious organizations and people who adhere to a traditional view of marriage?
Before we get to the religious liberty question, I wanted to ask you about something that seems to have concerned you. And it was a point, the question of whether or not the Supreme Court should have been more patient, that the states were already working this out, were headed in probably in that general direction, according to some. I mean, it was a point made by Chief Justice Roberts in his dissent. He pointed out that only 11 states in the District of Columbia had actually voted for same-sex marriage, and that the rest had it imposed upon him, at least from his perspective, through these court rulings. He wrote this. He said, "There will be consequences to shutting down the political process on an issue of such profound public significance," is how he put it. Would you talk about that, this idea that this wasn't done in the right way, I guess, from your perspective?
Well, it's not necessarily my perspective, but certainly the Chief Justice's perspective. And let me just be clear about my perspective. I mean, I think it's very easy. It is true that this was working itself out. And so I have a number of published papers talking about how, you know, within a matter of years, you were going to have every state be in a position to voluntarily enact same-sex marriage, whether it was by initiative or whether it was by legislation, or they would be in striking distance of doing that, meaning 45% of the population would be predicted to have supported same-sex marriage, which, at least in the voluntary same-sex marriage states, the 11 states and the districts that the Chief Justice is referring to, that's when you were sort of in the sort of zone for voluntarily embracing same-sex marriage. But even though it might happen, you know, in the near term, 3 to 5 years in many places, it's really hard to say to people who are locked outside the protections of marriage, hey, not you, right? And so, and it's interesting that this, you know, the majority uses exactly those terms, that you're locking people out of marriage. And there were some very, you know, very compelling things said about marriage by the majority that ironically, in any other context, would resonate with social conservatives. You know, the kinds of things that the majority is saying about marriage, that it's important for the adults, that it's important for the children, that it provides them these protections. I mean, those are actually lowercase c conservative values, right? And uppercase c conservative values, but not enough to overcome for many social conservatives the fact that they feel like the courts hijacked this. So now, I think the Chief Justice is right when he says that when this doesn't get done by the court, there are important horse trading and other things that are front and center for legislatures that they have to think about. What will the fallout for example, religious foster care and social care, you know, social services agencies be? Whether, as I said in an op-ed that ran in the New York Post yesterday, whether, for example, a church-affiliated nonprofit has to open its face to a wedding reception for a wedding that it can't even recognize. Now, those questions do get worked out when you have to have this done by voters or done in state houses. They did not get worked out here, and that's a big fight between the majority and the dissent.
So what you're saying is that same-sex marriage in blue states, for example, where they had already worked it out, what they had done is they had gone through the anti-discrimination stuff first and then moved to the marriage question. But what you're saying now is the problem is that since the court has imposed this idea on red states who had been resistant, that they're not going to have the same kind of opportunity to work out those anti-discrimination measures, that particular process in the same way?
Yeah, Doug, I mean, that just completely gets it right. With one little wrinkle, though. So go back to your blue states for a second. When you had same-sex marriage voluntarily embraced, it was a blue state phenomenon. In other words, these were states that already got behind the idea of gay rights. Every single one of those states had a pre-existing sexual orientation non-discrimination ban. In other words, things, by the way, that I think are needed, because we're frequently very mean to gay people. You know, like the idea that, you know, a kid who works at Red Robin is going to go to an Equality Utah parade or, you know, a gay rights parade and then walk in on Monday and get fired and his whole job is serving burgers. I mean, that's uncool, right? We need to provide protections to people in these sort of, in these things that all the rest of us take for granted. But the blue states made that kind of protection part of their law before they made marriage part of their law. And so when they came to embrace marriage voluntarily, they had to, if you want to think about it, almost clarify those pre-existing statutes to say that they were about commercial services like hiring, you know, or taxis or, you know, renting a large an apartment from a large, apartment building. But they were never meant to be about a thing that most people see to be a sacrament, marriage. Now contrast that with the red states. The red states, you know, are getting marriage before, and most of them, 28 of them, do not have sexual orientation and non-discrimination protections in statewide law. So that means that if you show up today to the baker or the photographer in one of these red states wanting to get your marriage, which state now must provide to you, right? That doesn't mean that that baker has to help you. In fact, if I was in one of these states and they wanted to discriminate on the base, if there was a non-discrimination statute that did not include gender, for example, I'm not sure that there are any, but if there was, I could walk into some store and they could just say, like, Wilson, get out because you're a woman, okay? In these states that haven't provided these sorely needed protections, those bakers and photographers can just say pack off because they've always been able to pack off. So it's ironic there's now a right to marry, but people aren't even guaranteed the ability to have their reception done by somebody. Now, you know as well as I do that there are lots of gay-friendly vendors, right? And people vote with their feet. But that's not a very satisfactory answer if you're like in a deep, deep red state. I'm going to pick Mississippi here, and only because Mississippi is the single most religious state in the country. If, you know, you're in like a really rural area of Mississippi, you might be able to get married, but there may not be anybody who's going to cater your wedding. And until you change those anti-discrimination laws, that's still going to be true.
Where do you put Utah in the scheme of things? Because Utah is one of those red states, obviously resistant to the idea of same-sex marriage. Yet it, in an extraordinary way, some would say, came together, gay rights advocates and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, to actually craft one of these anti-discrimination measures before, they, of course, they had made any sort of concessions to same-sex marriage. Is Utah just simply unique in that way?
Well, actually, I'm not sure it was before they made concessions. You'll remember that Judge Shelby recognized same-sex marriage, you know, said that there was going to be a federal constitutional right to same-sex marriage. That started rolling up to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court denied cert last November, and it left in place that decision. And that's a long way, Doug, of saying that Utah, in a microcosm, is where the country is right now. In other words, it had marriage come to it in a way that was not so happy for many people in Utah. They weren't ready for it in that sense. They might get behind it as an idea later, but they just weren't ready. They were caught off guard, like much of America today is. But Utah got it right in this way. They said instead of trying to pull back the apparatus of the state as it is supporting marriage, which some counties are doing now. You saw Pike County is saying we're not issuing marriage licenses to anybody, right? They're pulling back the state apparatus. You know, Utah just said we're not doing that. What we're going to do is we're going to extend a positive right in Utah law for the first time for somebody in the state to marry you, which has not been there. And then we're going to provide some protections for people who adhere to a traditional view of marriage, you know, like the Baptist marriage retreat. If the Baptists want to just have Baptists come to their Baptist marriage retreat, people who adhere to a traditional view of marriage, they can do that. That's the kind of concession that Utah put in law. But then they did something really staggering. They said, and it's not right the way we treat lesbian and gay people in our community as members of our community and hiring and in housing. And so we're going to provide them those protections. The reason I think that was good and decent is it's very easy to dig in after a law and just say, hell, I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to facilitate anybody's marriage then, right? Instead of doing that, the dig-in method, they said, let's, you know, think about how we live together in peace. And they ended an olive branch.
But if you take out the legislative threat, I'll put it that way, the threat that a court is going to act, as they did in Judge Shelby's case, if you remove that component, what's the incentive for a red state like Utah, or any red state or conservative state opposed to same-sex marriage, to enact anti-discrimination measures if there's not that threat urging them forward?
Well, okay, so let's talk then about the quote-unquote fallout after this decision. There are some live issues that can be used to, I think, craft compromises where both sides win. So one live issue, which I think is the canary in the gold mine, will be state licensure clerks, state judges who are authorized celebrants under state law to marry people. Now, in North Carolina, when you had same-sex marriage come to North Carolina before it was ready, right? You had a wave of resignations, either 6 or 8 different clerks resigning because they were not provided at that moment any kind of concession in law that resolved whether they had to do this, even if it violated their own religious conviction. What Utah did is it said for the first time in state law, somebody has to marry anybody who presents, gay person, black person, interracial people, interfaith couple, any kind of people. Somebody has to do that, but we're going to outsource that duty in a particular way so that any religious objectors who were in these jobs before same-sex marriage was recognized, sometimes anywhere in the world, that those people don't lose their job. So, yeah, did they have same-sex marriage, and did it take away a lot of the incentive that was in blue states to bargain? Absolutely. But did they find a way to make concessions so that the interests of both communities were protected? Yes. And those same kinds of concessions, at least, are a live fight now in all of these states.
You know, there was a lot of talk at the time of the passage of the anti-discrimination law in Utah that the Utah experience wouldn't translate. Because of the particulars of the story, which is to say mostly the influence of the LDS Church, that it wouldn't be a good blueprint to impose on other red states. But it sounds like you think that this may work, in fact, on other red states, or do you, I guess?
No, I think I do. I mean, there will be states where you're going to have, well, let's say two things about that. One is Senator Adams, the majority whip who ushered this through, did an amazing job, by the way. And I are talking to Idaho legislators in, you know, some weeks, okay? I've had people reach out from Indiana, people reach out from other states. And, you know, honestly, Doug, people are exhausted by this issue, right? You ask, where's the incentive? Maybe some of the incentive is just to have a culture war stop. As you said in your sort of tee up for the whole radio program, there are questions that are lingering, but they're not incredibly hard. They're not impossible to solve. Utah took a pretty good stab at it, right? And other states could do that. And then we can just lay all this to rest and move on. So I think that has great appeal to many people who really do want to come together with, you know, I don't know, not everybody was a marriage objector, right? So there's going to be big chunks of the electorate that are just like, come on, can't we get over this? Can't we find some solutions that are concrete and then move on? So you have those folks. And you also have folks that I think where you have, you know, now you have large stakeholders in many states who are religious communities because we're now talking about the red states, where those folks are going to be incentivized to go to the legislature and try to get this done. And you know what the legislatures are going to be terrified of? They don't want to be Indiana.
Well, that's what I was just going to ask you, how the Indiana's question comes into all of this, where of course, people boycotted the state after they passed a religious freedom law. I mean, that seems like a cautionary tale.
It is, but it's actually a tale that I think says to you, contrast that with Utah, that if you get it right and you don't try to do a judicial cram down so that one side wins at the expense of the other, then you have a way forward. Okay, that's what I think Utah stands for. You know, Indiana's a complex story because the kind of bill they tried to run is not what happened in Utah. Utah had specific exemptions. Think the Baptist marriage retreat. You want to do religious counseling, you did it before there was same-sex marriage, you can do it after. That's very specific. Hmm. Indiana was doing a thing called a Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which is like the act that was at the core of Hobby Lobby, the decision last summer, right? The other big decision last summer. And those are what I call generalized protections. In other words, they would exempt you from any law if that law if that law substantially burdens your religious practice and there was not a compelling interest or there was a less restrictive way for the government to do that. And a whole lot of people go right off the reservation when you talk about a Religious Freedom Restoration Act because they say that's placing you above the law, right? And a lot of folks in the RFRA fight, a lot of religious folks, sadly enough, said that they wanted these statutes to stave off gay rights. These are quotes, okay, outside of state houses. And when you say something like that, that law was not going to do that, okay? If you, Doug, ran a business in Indianapolis where they have a municipal ban on discriminating against gays, and you said to me, if I come in with my girlfriend to be married, my fiancé to be married, if you say, you are not going to do my flowers, and I sued you, there is no way you would win with the RFRA defense because an anti-discrimination law would be seen as a compelling interest and there would be no less restrictive way to get that done, okay? I really believe that. I think people who are identified with RFRA, anybody in the country, Doug Laycock, my co-author on a book, a different type of book, but in any event, he believes that. So you would not have won. But the problem, what happened in Indiana is that religious people said they wanted these laws for the wrong reasons, laws that would not have done what they wanted to do. And wholly, completely seem off the radar for most people was the fact that Indiana did not give the kinds of protections in state law that Utah now gives. Now, I think if Indiana had wanted to do the right and decent thing and say we can't be mean to gay people because of their sexual orientation, and then hold back some things that were unique to marriage because of the religious sacrament, that would have flown. That would have been successful, right? So it's a cautionary tale, but it's a cautionary tale about trying to do the wrong things in the wrong way.
Let me ask you about something. Running out of time, and I wanted to get to this point that you've made a few times, and that is that one of the things is that this ruling, you say, is raising questions about how we, here's how you put it, navigate real life issues of how we live together in a plural society. And I wanted you to say something about that, because what you said is that for religious people, people for which marriage, as you've said earlier, was the, you know, is this deeply religious sacrament, they need to find a way to relate to gay people, you say, and their marriages. Explain that part of this story. What do you mean by that?
Well, probably the easiest way. Well, let me say a couple things. One is, if you look at Utah, when they were providing some what I call step-offs, the ability for religious people to abstain from helping with something they can't recognize, like a religious nonprofit not opening a basement or, you know, a ground. Let's say they have beautiful grounds. They say, I'm sorry, I can't help you do your same-sex marriage reception on these grounds because we have a different religious conviction. That's what I call a step-off. They can't get in the way of gay people marrying because they don't actually, in that particular fact pattern, they're not actually marrying anybody. They would just be celebrating the marriage with the reception. They can't get in the way, but they can step aside. Now, if you aren't clear in state law, even those states that don't have anti-discrimination statutes, they do give these religious nonprofits tax exemptions, right? So they don't pay local taxes, they don't pay state taxes, and they're federally tax exempt. And one of the big questions at oral argument that in exchange between Alito and the Solicitor General of the United States, Borelli, was about exactly this question. You know, if you're a religious nonprofit and you're not down with same-sex marriage and you say, I'm not going to let my ground be used for that, does that mean your tax exemption is at risk? And, you know, the dissent goes after Kennedy on exactly this. They say, well, you haven't even talked about that. You know, you're providing kind of almost a glib answer, you know, about that, and they're worried about this question. Now, I've said, as I said in USA Today, race is always, this came out of a case called Bob Jones, where a school that was a religious university and nonprofit lost its tax-exempt status from the IRS because of an interracial dating ban. And the IRS just said, sorry, to be tax-exempt, you got to be a charity. To be charity, to be a charity, you can't have those kinds of values, right? Now people worry about whether, you know, not being down with same-sex marriage is one of those kinds of values. I don't think so, because I think race has always occupied a special. I don't think it has to be that way. Let me say it that way. Because race has always occupied a special status in our society. But trying to find a way where you recognize same-sex marriage without somehow washing out the religious character of religious communities is the project. And that's exactly what the 11 states in the District of Columbia did in their voluntary laws in different ways. Some said you could have Catholic student housing, that you still just opened up to heterosexual couples. They said, New York said that basically in its state law. Those are ways for people to live together even after a big change.
Robin Fretwell Wilson, professor of law at the University of Illinois. As I mentioned, she advised the Utah State Legislature earlier this year on the passage of that bill regarding LGBT rights and religious liberties. She joined us from Chicago. Professor, thanks very much for the time.
Absolutely. Thanks, Doug. I appreciate it.
801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are exploring the next step in the battle over same-sex marriage. Like everybody else, we're talking about the Supreme Court's ruling on Friday that made same-sex marriage legal in all 50 states. Talking about the reaction. Jubilation in some quarters, of course. Defiance, too, from others. It's going to be take a while for some people to get used to all of this. And we're talking about the legal implications, some of the social ones, too. Joining us now on the program is Clifford Roski, a law professor here at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law. I should also point out he's on the board of directors of Equality Utah. It's an LGBTQ advocacy group. And Professor Roski, welcome back. Thanks for being with
us. It's great to be here.
I wanted to jump into some of these points made by Robin Fretwell Wilson. And first is to that point, I guess really mentioned by the Chief Justice, about the fact that the states were already working this out. They would have gotten there eventually. Maybe it wouldn't have happened in June of 2015, but eventually they were all going to get there. And he's mentioned that I pointed this out. There will be consequences to shutting down this political process. They already had the wind at their backs. Why should the court intervene and really short-circuit the democratic process? What do you make of that argument?
Well, a couple things. First, the most basic response was the majority's response, which is the Constitution protects our most fundamental rights. And this case is about whether marriage is a fundamental right. The Supreme Court had said that 13 times, now 14. And the court has always been very clear that our fundamental rights are not subject to votes and elections. Why? Because the majority will always vote to deny fundamental rights to a minority. But there's also a deeper trend in the dissents, which is more troubling, which is this revisionist history of the gay rights movement, as if it was all this simply a democratic groundswell and the courts jumped in to interfere. And that's just as if the courts had nothing to do with the shift in public opinion. We know that's not true. Same-sex marriage started in Massachusetts as a result of a court ruling. California, Connecticut, Iowa, New Jersey, Vermont. That was part of the process through which Americans began to think through this issue and whether or not it should be something that's subject to a vote. And so Professor Wilson describes this as a voluntary phenomenon. Well, in many states, it wasn't voluntary. And for the public, it was both the legislatures and the courts and indeed popular elections. All of those things play a role.
Coming together.
Yeah, this is what democracies – courts have a role in democracy.
You made note in a piece of writing for an upcoming book of Scalia's writing in the Windsor case in particular, and he seemed to get a sense that something was coming. He wrote, "It's just a matter of listening and waiting for the other shoe," yeah, as he put it. So he did clearly see it coming. But I'm wondering what you make of his dissent. A lot of people see it as particularly strident, kind of nasty. Really went after the majority. Certainly went after Kennedy's writing. And I'm wondering what you make of that. Is it just his idiosyncratic way of looking at an issue, or does it say anything about the intensity of this issue?
I think it does say something about the intensity of the issue that not only Justice Scalia but the Chief Justice, who's known for being more moderate, and Justice Thomas and Justice Alito all at moments seemed to go so far in their rhetoric that it didn't seem quite judicious. When Justice Scalia says, if I had to sign that opinion, I'd, quote, hide my head in a bag. And then there was this really troubling thing where the Chief Justice and Justice Thomas referred to their colleagues as just lawyers. Which, maybe to a non-lawyer that insult gets missed, but the Chief Justice said they're just lawyers who happen to have a commission. And traditionally, the justices speak in terms of themselves as justices and as colleagues, sort of brethren and brothers and sisters. And there's a sort of you're just lawyers like anybody else. It was unusual for the court.
Utah, where this fits in the scheme of things. I'll get to Professor Wilson's point here in a moment. One of the things you've mentioned is that for better or for worse, this is your writing, Utah is still at the vanguard of the country's debates about LGBT rights. Do you think that's still the case? The church seems to have obviously now, but they even before the ruling were backing off some of these initiatives in states that were trying to ban same-sex marriage. Obviously, the anti-discrimination law that came up. What role do you see Utah, and particularly the LDS Church, playing now?
So I certainly think that Utah remains at the vanguard of the movement. It's funny. This has been an article that I wrote and had to revise for the last year.
And keep revising, probably, right?
Absolutely. So when I started, same-sex marriage was being litigated in the Supreme Court in Utah, and then it became legal, and that changed. And then we passed an anti-discrimination law, and that changed. And all of those things put us at the vanguard at the time. The fact that Utah is the only Republican-controlled state to ban employment and housing protection employment and housing discrimination against LGBT people puts us at the vanguard. It has been quite some time since any other state passed an anti-discrimination law. And last year, no other state passed any pro-gay legislation in the country. Five states passed anti-gay legislation. So that, I would say, qualifies as the vanguard.
To Professor Wilson's point that Indiana is the way not to go about it, Utah is the way to, in fact, to go about it. What do you say? Because you've expressed doubt. I remember talking to you before whether or not, in fact, Utah would be a proper blueprint. You've got the specter of the LDS Church, which makes everything different in many ways. Do you still think that?
Sure. That is, within Utah, Salt Lake City, you have the global headquarters of a religion that is the predominant religion in the state. Obviously, the church has significant political influence. The equivalent in many states, you're talking about Catholics and evangelicals, and there is no – the Vatican is in the Vatican. It's not in the United States.
Yeah.
So that's a difference. But there's another difference, which is somewhat legal. The exemptions that Utah has pre-existing – our new anti-discrimination law for religious organizations are very broad. They're about as broad as California's, but California and Utah have broader religious exemptions than almost any other state in the country. So, for example, churches can discriminate based on race, sex, disability, and religion. And so here, of course, also sexual orientation and gender identity. Most other states wouldn't consider allowing a church to discriminate based on race or disability. So it seems unlikely that that aspect of the law would be exported to other states.
Why wouldn't they embrace that? If you're a red state, you have just because it wouldn't legally fly. Is that what you're saying?
Well, no. I think politically it wouldn't fly either. I think there are some interesting questions about its legality. But on the federal level and in most states, we allow religious organizations to discriminate based on religion. So the Catholics don't have to admit Jews or Muslims or Mormons into their church. That seems rather obvious. That's part of what it is to be a religion. But religion, we think, doesn't have anything to do with anything other than religion, so that they should accept all people who are interested in entering their faith.
What did you make of Professor Wilson's argument that the dissenting justices took Justice Kennedy in writing the majority opinion to task for not really dealing with what could be the problem with this tax-exempt status question? What did you make of that?
I was surprised by that. Doug Laycock, who often works with Professor Wilson, agrees with me on this point. And the New York Times, he said, you know, this tax-exempt issue, this is a red herring. This is fairly absurd. It's true that the IRS will deny tax-exempt status to any nonprofit that discriminates based on race. But it's always been only race. So, for example, discrimination against women has been illegal for 50 years now. And obviously, the LDS Church, the Catholic Church, Orthodox Jews, many, indeed most Muslim sects, discriminate based on sex. You can't become a priest or an imam. No one has ever sought to deny those organizations tax-exempt status, even though they discriminate based on sex. The idea that LGBT people would suddenly be the reason for denying the tax-exempt status to all religious organizations is just implausible. No one has ever proposed it, other than people who are opposed to it, who want to sort of stoke fear, basically.
So the what are you expecting now in terms of other states trying to navigate their way around this ruling? States that obviously clearly were opposed to the idea in the first place. Is religious liberty that next battleground for them crafting these exemptions in Utah as a blueprint, but others?
So I think in other states, when people invoke religious liberty to oppose the progress of the LGBT movement, they mean something very different. I would call it so-called religious liberty. They're really seeking a license to discriminate, to continue discriminating against LGBT people, and to pick and choose which laws they can follow. This is what these Religious Freedom Restoration Acts would provide. Very dangerous, slippery slopes. You know, one person says, well, I don't want to help lesbians conceive. And the next doctor says, well, if he doesn't want to do that, I don't want to treat gay men who have HIV. What's the difference from a religious perspective? That's a, you know, how do we know where to stop? And I think the clear point here is that we don't –
How do you know when to stop?
I mean, if one were to take this idea, this new idea of religious liberty seriously, I don't think it has a logical stopping point. That is, we know that no one should be fired or evicted or denied goods and services based on their religion. And that's why all 50 states in the federal government ban religious discrimination. And but to go further than that and to say, no, I can discriminate against my employees, my tenants, and my customers because of my religion as a business owner, that really is not religious liberty. It's religious liberty for the business owner, but it's religious slavery for everyone else. It's a kind of religious tyranny. It's very dangerous, and it would allow one person to use religion as an excuse to impose harm on other people, and that's usually where we draw the line.
Here's an email from Jeff who writes, a county clerk has a job, which is to issue civil licenses for marriage. If they feel their beliefs prevent them from issuing these licenses to same-sex couples, they're free to believe that. But they will have to decide whether or not they want to continue being a county clerk or to swallow their objections and then issue the licenses. Claiming that their beliefs are more valid than those of the people who are paid to serve is not religious liberty. It's discrimination, I think, the point you were just making. Now, here's his other point. He says, on the opposite side of the coin, churches are not civil entities. They are within their rights to disapprove of same-sex marriage and shouldn't be forced to officiate them. A gay church member needs to decide whether or not they want to remain a member of a group that doesn't support their orientation. Jeff writes, finally, attempting to force a church to perform the ceremony is an assault on their religious liberties. Federal recognition of the validity of same-sex marriage is not.
Jeff nailed it. That's where you draw the line.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Professor Cliff Roske is joining us, a professor of law at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law. We need to take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, talking about the Supreme Court's ruling on Friday that made same-sex marriage legal in all 50 states. We heard earlier from Robin Fretwell Wilson. We have Clifford Roske on the program now, law professor at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law. So what's next is the question. Before we get to that, though, I did want to take up that issue, of course. How did Professor Wilson put it? The question, obviously, cakes, flowers. There's always another one. Photographs, I guess. And what now – what are the obligations of religious people who have these objections in the scheme of things?
And so here's another version of the question of where you draw the line. I think Professor Wilson is right to say that for many people, a wedding is a religious sacrament. But selling flowers to a wedding is not a sacrament. Baking a cake is not a sacrament. We all understand the difference between a communion wafer and a cake. That is, the person who provides the tablecloths is not performing a religious sacrament. We all know that ministers cannot be forced to perform weddings, but that's a totally separate question from how you make a buck in the public marketplace and which customers you serve.
And that's really what that's about.
Yes.
Are you going to be seeing that as a – do you see that as a scare tactic though?
I mean, I see that some people seem to disagree. Some people that have been, you know, selling flowers for a long time and apparently part of that in their minds is that they have to be able to discriminate. And so just as the county clerk – who participates in this public service has to say, well, which one is more important to me, issuing marriage licenses or discriminating? That, you know, florists have to make a choice at this point.
So let's talk about that next level, because you say the next level in the effort for equal rights is this idea of lived equality. What's the difference between legal equality and lived equality? Because there's a distinction.
So the distinction is basically that legal equality is when you get all your rights on paper in laws, particularly that the government can't discriminate against you. That's a clear sign of legal equality. But it's traditionally extended much further. So hotels and restaurants can't discriminate based on race or on sex, employers and landlords. So getting all of those anti-discrimination protections on the book, that would be part of legal equality too. So it's important to understand that what the Supreme Court mandated is that county clerks can't discriminate against same-sex couples, and probably their opinion would extend to any government actor. But the Constitution does not apply to private businesses and individuals. So you cannot sue a restaurant or a florist under the United States Constitution because they're not bound by it. That is, just like when your parents tell you to be quiet, they haven't violated your freedom of speech. When a restaurant refuses to serve you, they haven't denied you equal protection of the law. So we need anti-discrimination laws, as we see at the federal level and in Utah now and in many other states, to include protections for LGBT people. Before that, LGBT people, it's very hard for them to sue private businesses and individuals. So that's part of the legal equality agenda that remains unfinished. Lived equality is something much broader. This is, well, maybe I'm equal on paper, as LGBT people are in Massachusetts and in New York and in California. They have all the legal protections. But is that translating into everyday life? Are their health outcomes the same? You know, do they have adequate insurance, things like this? Are their wages on par with the wages of people who are not LGBT? So it's looking
and
more
it turns out no.
Yeah, absolutely not, right? Because discrimination works in complicated ways. Just because you can't say, I'm not hiring you because you're gay, doesn't mean that people aren't doing that without saying it. And so it's an effort to move beyond the law. As we've seen, it's been 50 years since the Civil Rights Act was passed. What just happened in South Carolina?
Right.
Right. I mean, there's a huge gap between the law and society.
You quote one scholar in your paper who said that it turns out formal legal equality does not provide more resources or greater political power or even better lives. So that's only the first step, the legal part, I guess.
Indeed. Campaign finance reform might be part of the lived equality agenda. If you're equal on paper, but some people have the power to buy politicians and dictate the outcomes of the democratic process, that means that you're not going to end up equal. They call it sort of a cradle-to-grave philosophy of equality, looking at actual outcomes.
So what's the strategy? Because on one hand, you're saying this is a way forward, but let's be careful. I mean, one of the things you've written about is that you're not entirely sure this should be the new paradigm for the LGBT movement. Explain that, if you would,
right,
because you have some reticence here.
Right. So the LGBT movement was, of course, built by people in some of our most liberal cities, in the blue states. So in San Francisco, in New York, in Washington, D.C., in Boston, and quite successfully in those states, first started by passing anti-discrimination legislation, particularly employment and housing, and then eventually public accommodations, and then moved on to the recognition of same-sex relationships. And now that they have achieved all legal equality in those states, when people ask what's next, they start talking beyond that paradigm into lived equality. And
so they're ready for the next step. Are they in Utah or other red states? That's your question.
Right. I think that's much more complicated because in the red states like Utah, marriage comes before work instead of the other way around. That is, marriage protections came before anti-discrimination protections. So that means that there are still, Utah aside, every other red state, every other swing state really lacks basic anti-discrimination protections for LGBT people. That seems like a high priority for the movement before we start shifting completely all of our resources into these more ambitious goals.
You point this out, 29 states without anti-discrimination laws, 20 states without hate crime laws.
Yes. And we see, and indeed one should really include Utah. We have a hate crimes law on the books, but no one has ever been convicted under it. And it was written so that no one would ever be convicted under it. And there was just a horrific hate crime in the past year in downtown Salt Lake City. And it will not be brought it will not be charged as a hate crime under Utah law, not because of anything wrong with the prosecutor, but because there's something wrong with the law itself.
So where does Utah's anti-discrimination law that was passed, where does that fit? Is that resolving any of those areas that you're – because you say in your piece that you often hear anti-discrimination laws described as merely formal or legal protections.
I do think that anti-discrimination laws are unique in that they cross the divide between legal and lived equality because they're speaking to issues like unemployment and homelessness, the inability to access public transportation and public services. These are among our most basic needs. They even have implications for the health care that employers provide. So when you think about lived equality, getting protections in an anti-discrimination law is the first step. But then, of course, you do have to look further and see whether those protections actually result in real gains.
The way forward, then, let's talk about that. This isn't because you say the LGBT movement is now going to get back to work to get anti-discrimination laws in place. You see, that is the way forward, and you say you're going to start to see these necessary shifts, two strategic shifts that you've laid out. One is spending more time local lobbying. Whereas before it had been sort of a national effort, now what you're saying is we've really got to fine-tune this and really get local?
Yes, and of course there's always been a local and federal work done in the LGBT movement. I'm talking about a shift in emphasis, though. We just see how much gridlock there is in Congress. It's unbelievable. They can barely keep the lights on. So the idea that they could pass comprehensive civil rights legislation in the next 4 years or something like that seems a little bit far-fetched. All of the Republican-controlled states redistricted, and so there are some people in Congress that can easily ignore any threat because of the way their districts are run. Their only threat is from the right in a Republican primary, and they have very little incentive to sign on to anti-discrimination laws at this point. On the other hand, I think Utah demonstrates that at the local level, it is possible to reach out to the Republican Party and gain broad-based support for LGBT rights.
So in a sense, then, what you saw happen with this anti-discrimination law where you had – which it did seem like an extraordinary image – leaders from the LDS Church shaking hands with members of the Equality Utah and other gay rights organizations. You see that coming together as a model in some way?
I mean – I think that the LGBT movement is going to have to start talking to Republicans. And frankly, we saw that in New York. New York was almost a Republican-controlled legislature when it passed a same-sex marriage bill. And so this is a development long in the works. There's been a lot of focus on the swing states. I think what was extraordinary about Utah is it wasn't a swing state. It is one of the two reddest states in the country. And so that was, of course, quite unusual. And we've seen in Congress a tendency to focus on disagreement and ignore agreement. So that is all the disagreements win and whatever agreements there are, whatever consensus is thrown out the window. But here we reversed that. We obviously disagree with the LDS Church on things like marriage and adoption. Completely, and probably always will. But we focused for a day, for a few weeks, on what we could agree on and try to make progress on that. And that seems, with the polarization of Washington, quite unusual these days.
I want to get this question out of the way, actually. It's not really relevant to where we are now, but I'm sure it's a question you get all the time. It's one from John. Who says if you take the Supreme Court decision to its logical conclusion, it leads to polygamy and other relationships, marrying dogs and cats and that whole other thing. How are you responding to that question?
Well, so there are really two questions there. Polygamy and bestiality are not the same thing because human beings and other animals are not the same. And so I was asked to respond to a question about bestiality before from one of our elected officials. And I think what I said then works now. I think all Americans recognize the distinction between human beings and other animals and that we are uniquely capable of intelligence and reason and therefore consent to sexual relationships. And to suggest at the moment that gay marriage is legalized that now bestiality must be legalized is really to compare gay Americans to dogs and cats, and that's very deeply offensive. The question of polygamy is a different one. We have an ongoing lawsuit. Right now it's the law, technically, that if you marry one person and then live with another in a sexual relationship and only for religious purposes consider that person a second spouse but don't attempt to get a second marriage license, that you can be thrown in prison for that. It's part of our Constitution. It was a condition of our statehood. And I think that raises profound questions about the fundamental rights of all Americans to pursue happiness. That is, this is not a question about can I get 50 marriage licenses and can one child have 50 parents. This is a question of whether people are thrown in prison for who they love. And I think that's a live question, and it's before the federal appeals court right now in Denver, and we'll see how it turns out.
Here's a dicier, more abstract subject I want to, I guess, end on. Paul writes this. He says, the root issue in this national debate is not and has not really been about sex, but it's about moral superiority. The Christians who dominate the extreme right wing of the Republican Party, Paul writes, can never accept that their intolerance regarding LGBT individuals rendered them less moral than their lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or queer adversaries. So to this idea that this is a moral question, and going back to Professor Wilson, who talked about what we have to figure out now is how to navigate through these, this moral groundwork and relate. How do we relate? This is a harder way forward because there's no legal structure to do this, it seems. So what do you make of that?
I mean, all political and legal questions are in some sense moral, but the question here is, was there more than morality at stake? And I think the Supreme Court found that there was. There was one of our most fundamental needs and rights, that is the need to enter into intimate relationships and express our commitment for each other in marriage. And then also the idea that there was a particularly unpopular, politically unpopular group of people here. It's not some coincidence. You know, gay and lesbian and bisexual people have been discriminated against for many, many decades in many, many ways, and this was just one of them. And when you have a fundamental right and a class that's really been discriminated against, that makes it about more than just morality. It's also about politics, and it's about constitutional law.
Are you advising people to not gloat, be nice, that it's going to be difficult? People who have been opposed to this are going to have a rough time with it. And are you saying, let's at least respect that on some level? I mean, what are you saying?
Gloating is never a good idea. Respecting other people is always a good idea. Following the golden rule. I don't like it when people gloat when I lose. And so I don't think gloating is the way forward here. I think listening more than talking is always the way to move things forward.
Clifford Roski, professor of law at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law, also on the board of directors of the LGBT advocacy group Equality Utah, joined us here in the studio. Professor, thanks.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. Our thanks to Daniel Lombardi. I'm Doug Fabrizio.